World Cup Talk. Christina here with the storylines that matter most in football today. Christian Pulisic is suddenly the most important fitness bulletin in the World Cup this morning. The United States is hoping he will be ready for the Australia match after that calf issue. And what makes this story bigger than a routine injury note is that it changes the emotional temperature around the entire U.S. campaign. When your captain and your most direct attacker is uncertain, everything starts to look more fragile. The attack looks less confident, the transitions feel less dangerous, and the pressure shifts onto supporting players who may not command the same defensive respect. That is why this matters beyond one player's medical update. It is really a story about how thin the margin is at a World Cup, especially for teams that depend on one star to turn good possession into real threat. At the same time, this is also a test of whether the U.S. has matured as a tournament team. A serious World Cup side cannot be emotionally dependent on one name, even a name as central as Pulisic. If he plays, the U.S. gains incision and leadership. If he does not, the larger question becomes tactical flexibility. Can they press a little smarter, protect the ball a little better, and create chances by structure instead of waiting for one player to solve the match? That is the part one find interesting. Injuries do not just remove talent. They expose whether a team idea is strong enough to survive stress. And speaking of stress, England's opening win over Croatia gave us one of the clearest early signals of the tournament. The result itself was loud enough, but the more interesting part was how England produced it. Several reports framed the match as a statement performance, aggressive in stretches, sharper than expected, and much more willing to attack the game than simply manage it. For England, that matters because this team often arrives at major tournaments carrying the weight of caution. When England looks free instead of fearful, the whole ceiling changes. There is one complication, though. Alongside the excitement came concern over Declan Rice after the match, and even small fitness doubts around a midfield anchor are worth watching. Rice is not just another starter. He is balance. He is the player who lets more creative teammates take risks because he can clean up danger and control tempo underneath them. So if England has found its attacking confidence, the next question is whether it can protect that structure physically over the coming days. A strong opening win starts a narrative. Squad health determines whether that narrative lasts. Another storyline that feels very podcast-worthy today is Portugal, and more specifically, the uneasy conversation around Cristiano Ronaldo. BBC coverage leaned into the idea that he struggled while other superstars around the tournament sparkled, and that instantly creates one of those irresistible World Cup debates. When does iconic status stop protecting a player from honest tactical scrutiny? Ronaldo still draws attention like almost no one else in football, but tournaments are brutally current. They punish reputation if the legs and rhythm are not there. What makes Portugal fascinating is that this is not simply about whether Ronaldo scores. It is about whether the team can be optimized around the present version of him rather than the memory of him. If a coach feels scared to take him off, as one headline put it, then the issue is bigger than form. It becomes a management question, a hierarchy question, almost a political question inside elite football. Can Portugal be ruthless enough to do what the match demands? The World Cup is full of teams trying to balance history and performance. Portugal may become the sharpest example of that tension. Away from the pitch, there is a really important fan experience story developing around the England game. Multiple reports focused on allegations that ticketless fans breached security by jumping turnstiles, while FIFA publicly downplayed the extent of the problem. This is exactly the kind of tournament issue that matters because it sits at the intersection of spectacle, safety, and trust. Fans do not experience the World Cup only through scorelines. They experience it through entry lines, policing, transport, pricing, and whether the event feels controlled or chaotic. If the tournament wants to present itself as premium, global, and family-friendly, then crowd management cannot become a recurring side plot. Even a limited breach creates an image problem, because people immediately start asking whether organizers are being transparent. The football can be brilliant, but if supporters feel unsafe or think access rules are unevenly enforced, that becomes part of the tournament's identity too. This is why logistics stories are never boring during a World Cup. They tell you whether the event machine is keeping up with the emotions it generates. That connects naturally to another thread from the last 24 hours, the growing argument over who actually profits from hosting this tournament. Coverage around host city economics, including reporting tied to Detroit and broader tourism analysis around Mexico City, points to a familiar but newly urgent question. The World Cup generates huge money and huge visibility, but that does not automatically mean every city or every local resident feels the upside in the same way. There can be short-term tourism spikes, branded celebration, and a lot of optimistic messaging, yet also high public costs, pressure on transport, expensive accommodation, and the sense that the biggest commercial winners may not be local at all. For podcast listeners, this matters because it changes how we talk about success. A packed stadium and big TV numbers do not settle the economics debate. They just decorate it. The real issue is distribution. Who takes the revenue, who absorbs the disruption, and who is left paying more for a once-in-a-generation event that is supposed to belong to everyone? The modern World Cup is not just a football competition. It is a giant temporary economy, and people are getting more comfortable asking harder questions about that economy while the tournament is still unfolding rather than years later. I also think Ghana deserves a mention after that dramatic 1-0 win over Panama, because one-goal tournament football can tell you a lot about nerve. It may not generate the same international noise as England or Portugal, but these are the kinds of matches that reveal seriousness. Winning tight, stressful games is one of the most transferable tournament skills there is. Ghana does not need the loudest headline to become one of the more annoying teams to face. Compact wins build belief, and belief can travel a very long way in June. And then there is the broader pattern across the day. The tournament already feels like it is separating teams with functional clarity from teams with unresolved questions. England looked like a side with momentum. The United States has an injury-shaped uncertainty around its biggest star. Portugal has a superstar conversation that is really about team design and authority. Organizers are being pressed on crowd control. Host cities are being judged not just on atmosphere, but on value. That mix is why the World Cup is so compelling right now. It is never only football. It is pressure, image, money, bodies, and decisions, all colliding in public. So if I had to give you the real headline of the day, it would be this. The World Cup is already testing whether teams and organizers can handle pressure without losing clarity. The best sides make pressure look like rhythm. The best tournaments make pressure look invisible. Over the next day or two, keep an eye on the Pulisic fitness situation, on whether England's midfield concerns grow or fade, on how Portugal manages the Ronaldo question, and on whether security and fan access remain part of the conversation. Those are not side notes. They are the stories shaping how this World Cup will feel. See you tomorrow.